argument today is United States against Harris.
That is so nice. You were sitting next to each other. We never see that.
Ms. Griebel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Erin Griebel, and I appear on behalf of Victoria Harris, the appellant. I'd like to start off, Your Honors, with saying that Victoria Harris was denied a continuance for her sentencing hearing due to, the complexity of the discovery in this matter. And it turns out, though, that this had a direct bearing on an objection that was lodged.
I gather from what the district court said that there had already been 8 months' delay as a result of many prior motions. Is that correct?
It's correct that there are three prior motions to continue, and the one at issue was the fourth, Your Honor.
And the total delay the district court had already granted was 8 months. Was that also correct?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
At some point, the district judge has got to have the authority to say fish or cut bait.
Certainly. I think that, though, it's not, I don't know that it's fair to say that all of those delays were due to the defendant, because the discovery was an ongoing process, and also the government itself was dependent upon the expertise of MetLife to determine not only the loss amount in total, but the number of victims. And that is what really became the primary issue then at sentencing with regard to the 2B1.1 enhancement.
But presumably you've had sufficient time to review all the records now. Is there anything in the record that could pull the amount of the loss below $2.5 million? I mean, didn't you, wasn't there an admitting to approximately $5 million as an appropriate amount for the loss? So what harm was caused here by the denial of the continuance?
The number of victims, Your Honor. The number of victims was very much close to the cutoff for the 50 or more. So we have in the revised addendum to the PSR count of 48, if you make a simple count. And then we have the revised PSR itself is the same. But then realizing that 48 is less than 50, the government then decided to advocate that, in fact, that number is 61 if you take the 23 married couples and double them and count them as individuals, and that takes you from 48 to 61.
Wait a minute. That math doesn't add up at all.
Your Honor.
Math doesn't add up at
sure.
all.
Sure. So there are 22 individuals, 13 couples.
I thought you said there were
13 trusts and estates.
You just told me there were 23 married couples.
I apologize, Your Honor. There would have been 13. If you take that number twice, the total lifts from 48 to 61. I apologize.
Wait. The court found there were 57 victims, right? Even if you counted all the married couples as single victims.
I believe so, Your Honor.
If the married couples were counted as two victims each, then the court found there would be 75 victims. Either number seems to exceed 50.
Well, okay. I think that's true, but the issue was that the defense counsel and Ms. Harris contended that, in fact, it was lower than 50, and that a simple count of the PSR that the government did not object to would have reflected that as well, a simple count of 48. And so eliminating the victims becomes something that is a real issue that certainly, at least from Ms. Harris' position, could have been dealt with prior to sentencing.
Eliminating the victims? Did you hire a hitman to go out and bump them off?
No, Your Honor. I believe that was Mr. Bucknan that was cited in the brief. I believe that was his scheme. To lower his count. Not so here, Your Honor. So the issue then is that just prior to the sentencing that ultimately wasn't continued, there was a meeting with MetLife and the U.S. Attorney's Office and our clients and ourselves as well. And so what no one, I think, realized, the government included, was pertinent was that MetLife, in fact, did not have bank records from 2005, 6, 7, and 8 for those years. Well, it didn't occur to anyone that MetLife was anything but an expert in determining exactly how much it lost and from who. But in fact, they had a software change in 2006 that made things relatively clear. Prior to that, less clear. And in fact, what you have were amounts, but without the matching names and the dates and then the ultimate destination. The other problem with the MetLife information that certainly wasn't clear to the government or to our office, if I may speak for them, is that MetLife was not able to determine funds that were reinvested, albeit delayed reinvestment, to a group outside of MetLife. And so then the bank records become rather pertinent. And so the Shively check is the one that's discussed in the brief, where that person was actually determined not to have suffered a loss, even though she, in a certain respect, suffered gained a windfall because she was reimbursed by MetLife. And so Ms. Shively, among others, who were not only made whole, but some of them suffered no loss at all. But what's particularly important about Ms. Shively is that that was determined by then going to the actual bank accounts, which I couldn't begin to say why MetLife thought that that wasn't an important way to go, and it seems that they didn't tip off the government to that fact either. But when one was invalidated that way, and then the client with that information presumed that or seemed to think there might be four more, we also have the government tagging 133 checks, Ms. Shively's among them, for follow-up. Whatever that means, we still don't know. We know that it wasn't done.
Counsel, let me ask you. Suppose somebody were to agree with you that as a matter of law, a district judge is required to count married couples or joint account holders as one person. You'd go back to the district judge. No facts would have changed. Why should it matter at all under Section 3553A whether one counts married couples as one person or two for purposes of the guideline?
I'm sorry, 3553A, Your Honor?
Yes.
Or the guideline?
Why should it matter when the district judge exercises authority as required under the statute, 3553A, what the guidelines say about that particular nuance? No facts would have changed. He's still dealing with the same conduct, the same harm, the same character, the same history.
And as much as it impacts the severity of the offense, I think that does fit under 3553A. I think that there's an indication.
Why? There's no difference in the facts that would be presented to the district court on remand, right?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because the government wasn't called on to present whether or not the folks were married at the time of the investment or were simply married at the time of the investigation. So there certainly could have been folks counted.
I've got to say, this sounds like real cruelty to victims at this point. You're talking about, you're complaining about the failure to grant yet another continuance.
Mm-hmm.
The government pointed out we've got a lot of elderly victims who've been betrayed by Ms. Harris, who keep getting these notices from the government about a court hearing for sentencing and then get told, no, it's being put off again and again and again, and there's no closure, there's no resolution. It seems to me it's perfectly reasonable for the district court to say it's time to get this done.
I think the counterbalance to that, Your Honor, though, is that certainly they were upset and angry, and there's no diminishing the betrayal that they suffered. But financially, they were reimbursed by MetLife, and it would seem from our perspective that a bit more time would not have increased the harm to those victims. And so I think that that's what's different.
That's easy to say from that perspective.
It is, but, Your Honor, it's also a matter of the district court having a complete information, and I think the reliance in this case was more so on MetLife than might be shared. I think the parties depended on MetLife more than they might depend on a third party in other cases, so in that way I think that this is special if we look at the spectrum of criminal offenses. And when MetLife is using a certain methodology and yet not releasing its actual spreadsheet to defense counsel, and so defense counsel is left to piece it together, and then they discover that another methodology that they hadn't pursued would actually invalidate what was
Let me ask you a question. Under your theory, let's suppose we had a married couple being victimized at the time of the fraud. And by the time of the sentencing and the time the case is resolved, both of those folks have passed away, mm-hmm. and their estate and its claims are now spread among 10 mm-hmm. grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Are there 10 victims, one or two?
Our position is certainly one.
Why? You've got 10 people at the time of sentencing who say they have been victimized by that loss.
Well, what I don't see in the guideline is something that tells us that it can be, that the harm can then continue to funnel to, can be derivative in that way, to funnel down. So if I suffer a loss and then 10 years from now I have children, if that's
let's suppose that the victim is a trust mm-hmm. at the time mm-hmm. and it has 10 beneficiaries. One victim or 10?
I think it depends, and I think that the language in Densmore is...
Depends on what?
I think the language in Densmore illuminates it because it says where they were in fact joint account holders, where the funds were invested on both of them, then you could count them separately. But that is just something that is not necessarily true just by virtue of being a joint account holder at the time of the investigation without looking at all in terms of the nature of the investment and on whose behalf it was made. Seems to be an unfair assumption, and when it elevates the guideline level like it does here.
Well, this is frankly, the position is elevating the guideline details to an absurd level of specificity.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead. Your time.
I have a question about your client's status. Was she in prison when she asked for the continuance?
I'm gonna go with no, Your Honor, although I'm not totally certain, but I don't...
That's obviously one of the things the district judge would consider, that if you have somebody who's out of prison, you receive a request, you understand a request as stalling. Somebody who's in prison and says the delay will be on my head might be taken more seriously. So your client say to the district judge, I think this continuance is very important. I will go to prison now if you just allow my lawyer more time to prepare. Any such offer?
There wasn't an offer, but the defense counsel certainly said that there was no desire to continue it. And in the transcript of that hearing, I don't know that the district court took it as stalling, considering that the meeting where the Shively check was discovered and then MetLife was still investigating and still retracing accounts occurred the Monday before. And so the reason that the continuance came at that time, and in fact, I don't know that the district court thought that because they entered a memo.
I asked you a question of fact.
Sorry.
Was there such an offer? I will go to prison now, and the time will be on my head.
There was not.
Okay.
But I would add,
Your Honor.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, almost afternoon. First off, I do think there's just an advantage to have someone do the oral argument that actually lives the case. First off, she was on bond at the time. And to be very clear, I agreed to some of the earlier continuances in an effort to make sure we had the loss within a reasonable degree of certainty. I then did file an objection to the last continuance because the loss was at that reasonable degree of certainty. So the question is, first off, there's no question, and I can explain why, that the loss was within a few dollars of what the court found, and it would never get below $2.5 million. We have an agent that independently, well, two agents, one from Illinois Securities, one from IRS, independently looked at 8 bank accounts, traced out all the records. That's on that side. Then we had the internal audit by Gene Phillips, a certified fraud examiner from MetLife, on the inside, going through their software, going through the client's files, and their numbers reach the same result. So I did oppose the continuance. Number of victims, first issue. The court need not find today whether married couples constitute a single or separate victims, because the court found, and it wasn't clearly erroneous, by government's Exhibit 1, you just merely go down the list and total up the victims. You can look and see who looks to be a married couple. You'll find there's 19. That equals, I did bad math. I apologize, because it would actually only be 15 married couples, because the court found there'd be 72 if they were married, 57 if you counted them as married couples as individuals.
Do you know where we'll find that in the record?
Yes. You'll find it in the court's order, which is very good, post-sentencing. That's at record 45, page 2. You're also going to find that in the sentencing transcript at page 119. And it's very clear just by looking at Government's Exhibit 1 that was admitted at sentencing.
Okay.
But dealing with that issue briefly, it really wouldn't matter, and I don't know what the confusion is, whether they're married, not married, whether they're brother and sister or neighbors. At least the testimony in this case, they were clients. Because they were clients, the investment was made on their behalf. So you don't lose a legal status as an individual once you become married. So there's 72 victims. And it's any person under the guideline definition of who is a victim. It's any person who sustained the loss. But in answer to your question, there's a foreseeability requirement. And if you're dealing with a client, you have that foreseeability. If you're dealing with a residual beneficiary, you would not necessarily have the same foreseeability. You might, but that would be the issue to analyze. So for the denial of the continuance, you would need an abuse of discretion and actual prejudice. That prejudice has not been shown and could not be shown. Regarding the objective reasonability of the sentence she got, just to point out a couple of things. Because we have our chief judge who said on the record, with all sincerity, that with 13 years on the federal bench and 7 years on the state bench, he's never seen someone like Victoria McGee Harris, who had the range of ingratiating herself with her victims, but yet treating some others with hostility. Now, the victim impact statements, you can go to sentencing transcript 169 through 170. I'd just like to point out three. Tomika Aldridge was a victim. She was 76 years old at the time, an immigrant from Okinawa, Japan, and therefore she could really speak or understand little English. Victoria McGee Harris, the defendant, visited her in the hospital while her husband was suffering from a heart attack. Her husband ultimately died from that heart attack. Then Victoria McGee Harris went back to Tomika Aldridge and had her invest, and she stole all of her money right afterwards. Henrietta Byrd, 80 years old at the time, legally blind. Her husband couldn't see very well. I'm sorry, that's the representative of the victim. The victim was actually Hildegard Schutte. And there was evidence that Victoria McGee Harris always hugged and kissed her mom when she was visiting, saying how much she loved her. As she was hugging and kissing her, saying how much she loved her, she was stealing all of her money. Lastly, Carol DeRusset, again at sentencing transcript 169 through 170. Through a serious bout of skin cancer in which I had 17 cuttings on my face to remove the cancer, 4 plastic surgeries to rebuild the nose and mouth area, Mrs. Harris was dealing with her at the time while she was going through all of this. She routinely stole money that I thought was being invested. When I questioned the volume of my investments, she would become incensed, losing her temper and behaving in an uncontrolled manner, which was her way to minimize any future questions. That's 3 of 72.
Only 69 more to go.
And I'm going to be out of time. Okay. But if you have any questions, this to me looks like an easy one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Ms. Grable, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.